Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Paula McLean, whose latest novel is Circling the Sun. Paula McLean is the author of The Paris Wife, A Ticket to Ride, and a memoir like Family, Growing Up in Other People's Houses. This book, Circling the Sun, tells the early life of Beryl Markham, who was an extraordinary woman who lived to be 84. But during her early days, she was part of a group of people in Kenya and then became a leading aviatrix. So we're going to pick up where we left off on Paris Wife, which is at that point you were working on a novel about Marie Curie.
What happened is I failed. I failed pretty miserably for about 2.5 years and wrote multiple drafts, and nothing ever worked. Nothing ever kind of crackled with Marie. I couldn't find her voice. I couldn't find the right point of view. I felt like I was underneath my research. And what I couldn't understand is why. I mean, all the pieces seemed to be in place. You know, she was such an inspiring woman. There were elements of her biography I connected with very deeply. She lost her mother at a young age. She had a profound connection to her older sister, so I connected with that. And then there's Paris again. There's Paris in 1894, and there's her research. There's the intensity with which she does her work and how much she cares about her work. There were all these levels of connection and yet no heat.
When you say that, you know, it means you couldn't find her voice, right?
Indeed.
What exactly does that mean? Did you try a third person, first person? You tried everything there?
I tried everything, and standing in my head included. I tried absolutely everything. Tried Pierre's point of view.
When you reach that point and you're trying that, what tells you that something isn't working?
Mostly it's the physical experience of trying to go to the desk every day and then wanting to, like, whack my head against the wall. There's an emptiness or a flatness or a detachment to the work, to the feeling. Do you know what I mean? Sort of like when things are going well, time dissolves, and I can be at my desk for 4 hours or 5 hours, and it feels like a blink because I'm wrapped up, because I'm swept away. And the words, I'm not saying that they spill out of my body, but it all feels organic, and it feels like it's headed in the right direction, and there's an intensity to the work. And when I feel disconnected, which I did for almost the entire 2.5 years that I worked on the Marie Curie book, it's like the opposite of what happened to me when I found Hadley Richardson and began to work on The Paris Wife. I mean, that book just kind of rocketed right out of my brain. It was so awesome. It was a really exciting time.
And then you were floundering around like that, and your future brother-in-law gave you a copy of
West with the Night, which is Beryl Markham's memoir about her adventures and her sort of daring feats.
When you read West with the Night, which is about Markham's later life and leaves a lot of material from Circling the Sun, was it her voice that grabbed you? It's written first person. It's a memoir from 1942, though apparently it did nothing until the 80s. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. When it was reprinted in 1984. So when I first sort of was given the copy of this book, I was working on the Marie Curie, and my brother-in-law, who is a doctor but also a pilot, was reading West with the Night when we went on vacation, and he kept looking at me when he was reading by the side of the pool in Orlando and saying, "This woman is amazing, and you need to know about her because she's inspiring and you're going to write about her." And people tell me all the time. They feel quite free, in fact, to tell me what I should be writing. And so I ignored him and took the book home and put it on my shelf, and it sat there for 1.5 years before I picked it up one day, kind of at the edge of reason, and read one paragraph and just felt a sizzle of connection. So what do I mean when I say the voice? I mean, I studied poetry, you know, and my early career as a writer is all about language. So there's a primitive and kind of mysterious connection that I have to language, to words, and there was some quality in Beryl's voice, her tone, her diction, her style, her particular stance, her essence, that really came across to me as instantly compelling and fascinating, and I just needed to know more about her life. So that's really all it was just this bolt of lightning saying, dig here, like look more.
And at that point, Paula McLean, you went out and got, Straight On Till Morning, the bio?
Yeah, I didn't read Straight On Till Morning right away, the Mary Lovell, which was the first biography of Beryl, and really an amazing biography. I read another by Errol Trebinsky called The Lives of Beryl Markham, and started there, and then found the Lovell, and then went to Karen Blixen's letters, because Karen Blixen was a great, I wouldn't call her a friend, but an intimate of Beryl Markham's for many years when they were living in colonial Kenya together, and they were both involved with the same man, the safari hunter Dennis Finch Hatton, which, of course, is not mentioned in West with the Night, nor is it mentioned in Out of Africa.
That was amazing for me because I didn't remember Out of Africa. It's been so long since I've seen it. But when I went to IMDb, I looked for Beryl Markham's name. It's not under any name. It's not in the film whatsoever. And it's not in Isaac Dennison's book either.
No, it's not. And that's interesting to me. Out of Africa is my favorite movie, and I have whole chunks of it memorized, and it's been my favorite movie for decades. And there is, now that I know Beryl's life, and I know her biography, and I know the connection, there is a Beryl Markham stand-in in the film, and it's this young, horsey girl named Felicity, who sort of has a couple of walk-on moments and is suggested at one point in the film to perhaps be a very minor rival for Dennis's affections.
In fact, in the movie, Dennis, that's a character played by Robert Redford, clearly goes off and has affairs all the time and keeps coming back to Karen Blixen, who is Isaac Dennison.
Right.
I mean, that's there in the film.
It is in the film. The tension in the relationship is in the film, the way that he was such a free spirit, the way he wouldn't be pinned down, the way he wouldn't make a promise to Karen and couldn't be monogamous.
Karen Blixen wrote a number of letters, and some of your information comes from that?
Yes. In fact, Karen's letters was really sort of a tremendous boon for me as a researcher, because when I would find these gaps between Beryl's biography and West with the Night, I often went to Blixen's letters. So, God bless her, Karen Blixen wrote her mother every Sunday for decades, and that's how I know a lot of this stuff happened.
And that's how you know that Beryl Markham's mother was at the cottage and it rained in on her and she had to leave?
Exactly. And so many things like that. When Beryl was fighting with Jock, her first husband, and turns up at the farm, and sort of all the things that are happening in Beryl's life at that moment that she herself is famously tight-lipped about, I know from Karen Blixen's letters.
Let's get back to Beryl here, because we'll go into a little bit of her life. But what I found really interesting, and I mentioned this just before we started, was that I started going to Wikipedia and a couple of other places, and what's there is very different from what you have in Circling the Sun. Wikipedia's piece on Beryl Markham took me to Prince Harry's piece. Prince Harry was the
Duke of Gloucester.
The first son was David, who became Edward, who abdicated, King of England.
Or Wallace Simpson.
The second was Albert, who became George, Queen Elizabeth's father.
Which we know from the King's speech.
Well, I know that before that. But and the third, of course, is this guy, Harry.
Harry.
Now, when I went to Harry's bio, it said flat out that he had an affair and probably a child with Beryl Markham. When I went to the Beryl Markham page, it said there was definitely an affair. And yet, Paula McLean, in Circling the Sun, you say there wasn't.
No, I actually don't say there wasn't. What I say is it's nobody's business. That's what I actually am saying in the book. So Beryl Markham was, you know, sort of the target of gossip and speculation and innuendo and a target for scandal her entire life. And if you go to her Wikipedia page, it seems that her accomplishments as an aviatrix, as an author, as a horse trainer, as a badass, are all overshadowed by sort of the smoking gun of her personal life and whom she did or did not sleep with. And the more I started to research her life, Richard, the more I became sort of irritated at why we're so curious about who she did or didn't bed And so when I got to that piece, the gossip about Harry, and in fact she was rumored to have slept with both of them, with David as well, and Harry simultaneously, and also this speculation that Beryl's only son, Jarvis, from her marriage with Mansfield Markham, was actually Harry's child, which is actually biologically, medically impossible. Harry and David came over to Kenya to have a safari in 1928. They arrived in October to great fanfare, and Beryl was pregnant in June, which doesn't keep everyone, even family members, from insisting that that child is Harry's, which is, people just love to gossip. People love gossip, and it doesn't matter if the truth comes along, they prefer gossip.
To me, when I read the book, it pretty much said that she didn't sleep with him.
There are a lot of scenes in the book where Beryl is confronted with, you know, an accusation, either by Mansfield or by others in her set, you know, are you doing this? And what she does is refuse to talk about it. And because that was Beryl's own stance in her life, that's the position that I decided to take kind of provocatively, honestly. And because I had just found, I just started to find the gossip so distasteful and also kind of absurd when you think about this remarkable woman who really took on so much and in many ways is so inspiring. Why do we seem to be so caught up in her sexual exploits?
She, in some respects, Paula McLean, seems a modern person in the way that they looked at celebrity. So they link her up with everybody, but it's also true, as is pointed out in Circling the Sun, that the line, are you married or do you live in Kenya, seems particularly appropriate. This was a small group of people, like the Paris people of Paris Wife.
Bohemians in Nairobi as opposed to Jazz Age Paris, indeed.
This was a very modern, in a sense, group of people, except for the fact that they gossiped, and the gossip was really hurtful.
Yes, it was. And I think one of the reasons that Beryl was such a target in this group that seemed to be to have no kind of qualms about engaging in all kinds of sexual experimentation. I mean, bordering on what was seen in England at the time as sexual depravity and debauchery and hedonism. And yet Beryl was still a target in that world where basically there are no rules. And see, that's the tricky bit. That's the tricky bit because, of course, there were rules. And the rules were very complicated about discretion and about whom you could and could not reveal certain aspects of your behavior to. And Beryl didn't like to follow the rules. And also, she wouldn't defend herself when she was accused of doing this or that. I mean, she was famously tight-lipped. She didn't want to talk about her personal life. She didn't think it was anyone's damn business.
There's a couple of other elements. She was a beautiful woman.
She looked like Greta Garbo. She was almost 6 feet tall, and she carried herself with kind of a great confidence and had a lot of magnetism sexually. You know, men were drawn to her. Women were made uncomfortable by some of the ways that she comported herself.
But it was also a time and a place, particularly a place where women could do things that they normally couldn't do, and she did it early on. She was a horse trainer, a known horse trainer, a famous one by the age of 18.
Exactly. I mean, she was the first licensed female racehorse trainer in Africa, but very probably the world. She grew up on a horse farm in Njoro, which is 100 miles upcountry from Nairobi. Her father was a racehorse trainer. She could ride a horse before she could walk. It was what she knew best. And so when Beryl sort of was plunged into a disastrous marriage before she was 17 years old and wasn't happy in that marriage and didn't know what to do with herself, she actually went to work. She used the only tools that she had, and she sought out this license because she didn't know how else she might support herself. And I actually love that. I love the practicality of that, the way that sometimes feminism is simply, you know, sort of like doing what you can to sort of to make do, make a living.
And she did it again when she became an aviatrix. Same thing.
Exactly the same thing. I mean, Beryl simply saw these challenges in the world and flung herself at them. And to me, she seems much more like Hemingway, or like a Hemingway character, in that she simply follows her own compass, no matter what anyone else is saying and no matter what it costs her.
Is the voice of Beryl that we read, his first person encircling the sun, is that the same voice in a way as West with the Night?
So if you're asking if readers read West with the Night and read my novel Circling the Sun side by side, will it be obvious to them or recognizable? No, I don't think so, actually. And in fact, if a reader had Hadley Richardson's letters and The Paris Wife, Hadley's voice in The Paris Wife wouldn't be instantly recognizable side by side with her letters. Because, of course, I'm not Hadley. I'm not really Beryl. It's an amalgamation. You know, it's a hybrid, this voice that I'm using in Circling the Sun. And it's a riff off of West with the Night. It's my version of Beryl. And it's the voice that I found when I began to fling myself at her story. And it's the voice that I was most comfortable with. And that's the trail that I followed.
And that voice is the one that came to you quickly. It said, "Hi, I'm here." Of course, I understand you began writing this thing, not telling anyone because they thought you were still working on Madame Curie.
Exactly. Well, I had a contract with Ballantine, my publisher. Yeah, the expectation was that I was working on that book and that I was still in the trenches on that book. When I told my agent, one of the very few people who knew that I was in real trouble with Marie Curie, that I was thinking about writing another novel about Beryl Markham, she's like, "Okay, yeah, do whatever you need to do to take care of yourself and write whatever you need to, but maybe let's not tell the people who, you know, you've signed papers for right away." And of course, I didn't know that that wasn't going to be a failure too, the Beryl Markham novel. I mean, I was really deeply stuck. But what happened instead was like Shazam. The first draft of Circling the Sun came out of me in 5 months, which is the fastest I've ever written anything in my life.
It sounds like what happened was you began immersing yourself in Beryl's life, finding all these great contradictions. And the great thing about a novelist is that you can kind of pull the strings out. Is that pretty much it?
That's exactly what it is. And that's the fun part for me, is like finding those gaps and those sort of lurching absences. So if you read West with the Night, for instance, Beryl writes so magnificently about her record-breaking flight. She writes about horse training. The horse stuff is gorgeous. She does write about her African childhood. She writes about being mauled by a lion when she's 10 years old. But it's all pluck and derring do. And what's missing, which was so obvious to me, is the vulnerability and her personal life. You know, West with the Night is not an autobiography. She's not interested in spilling the dirt, the goo. For instance, she was married 3 times. There's not a single mention of her husband. She had this son, Jarvis. He's never mentioned. It's never mentioned that she was abandoned by her mother when she was 4 years old, who returned to England, and that woman was gone from her life for 16 years. In fact, in West with the Night, there's no mention of any woman except Lord Delamere's wife, who became Beryl's surrogate mother for a brief time in her girlhood and who later died.
So there was plenty of room for you to expand without even departing from the historical record, because there's almost an infinite number of historical records.
Exactly, exactly. But that's a really rich ground for a novelist, in fact. And so how the book really began was starting with West with the Night, sort of looking into biographies and then finding questions. So, for instance, in biographies, I found that Beryl was involved, in fact, for 10 years in this really complicated love triangle with Karen Blixen, who wrote Out of Africa under the pen name Isak Dinesen, and Dennis Finchatten, this great white hunter, the safari hunter, who we know from the Sidney Pollack film as Robert Redford, right? Fabulous. That's a fabulous romance. In fact, it's one of the most sort of delicious love stories in history, and yet it's over-perfected and over-romanticized, and this woman, Beryl Markham, who was very involved in their lives, has been erased from the historical record.
Sort of erased, because we all sort of vaguely in the back of our minds, a lot of us have actually heard of her. I'd heard of her, but I didn't really know anything about her.
Yeah, and that was a big question for me, too, as I began to research her life, is why don't I know who this woman is? Amelia Earhart, who is her contemporary, is America's darling, and Brell Markham is just an afterthought. She's a footnote.
There's a couple of other areas I want to talk about here. Briefly, let's talk about colonialism and what that would have been like for someone like Beryl. For instance, there's a great article you wrote in Town and Country.
Basically, after I finished the novel, I went over to Kenya to sort of follow the footsteps of Beryl Markham, and then I wrote about it for Town and Country and traced the ghosts that are still there, the people who still knew her, the places where she lived. I was able to, for instance, you know, sit in the sun at the Ngong race course where Beryl ran her beloved thoroughbreds and have a long conversation with this fellow named Buster Parnell, who was Beryl's jockey for 20-something years, you know, and on and on and on. I went to Soysambu, which was the ranch where Beryl went to train racehorses for Lord Delamere in 1922 and met the current Lord Delamere, you know, who fed me lemon cake and I met his lovely wife and toured the property and found, to my kind of shock, that the cottage that Beryl lived in 1922 is still standing, and the stables and the pastures, everything is exactly the same, as if time has not passed.
Well, having done the research and having gone there, what are your feelings about British colonialism?
You know, I mean, it's such a difficult period in Kenya's history, and yet in another way, it was so brief. It was so brief. It was only 60-some-odd years, right? And if you think about all of geologic time and all of the other periods of Kenya. And yet it's a very difficult shadow to throw off, very difficult shadow to throw off. And I felt that quite clearly when I was there meeting the current Lord Delamere, for instance, whose staff is sort of off in the shadows. He's a baron, you know what I mean? He's like the landed gentry. And why does he have that position? So how has he really earned it? And the land that his grandfather, the original Lord Delamere, purchased from the indigenous people, was that really for sale?
Charles Clutterbuck, her father, Beryl's father, what was it, £1,000 got you 1,000 acres?
Yes, it was a shilling an acre. That was the going rate for land in these soldier settlement kind of lots where you could leave, as the expats did, you know, Europe and Ireland and England and sort of fling yourself at untamed Africa and sort of buy up these huge, huge chunks of land.
Well, some of that comes, I guess, in her relationship with her girlhood buddy, Kibi, who I guess did exist. I would assume that you created a lot of that relationship yourself, or does she talk about it?
So if you read West of the Night, Beryl is very nostalgic about her father's horse farm, Green Hills, which was 100 miles upcountry from Nairobi in Injoro in Kenya's Rift Valley, and about this childhood, her most essential friendship, the primary friendship of her life, which was with Kibi, this young Kipsigis boy on her father's land, who is her most trusted kind of ally, but also her fiercest competitor. And that's the part that really intrigued me, is how, you know, after Beryl's mother left the family when Beryl was 4, my analysis of Beryl, the way that I psychologize her, is that gap, you know, that crushing loss really sent her into this role of sort of this fierce warrior in training with Kibi. And it was a role that was kind of not available to girls, not white girls, and certainly not the girls in Kibi's family group as well. You know, they were not sort of privileged to go out running off into the bush and hunting warthog the way that Beryl was. And it was because she had this quite rare privilege of position, I suppose, is what it was, because her mother had left and because nobody knew what to do with her. She was the white daughter of their white kind of Bwana, the landowner, and how are they going to tell her no if she wanted to go off sort of hunting warthog?
Later on in life, he changes his name when he becomes a man, but continues to work with her with horses, and I guess that's part of the bio?
That is part of the bio. So after Kibbe's initiation ceremony in adolescence, the circumcision ceremony, he becomes a warrior, and she is forced to go get married because, of course, the dream ends, right? Her ferocity, you know, her freedom as a young woman ends when she has to get married. And then Kibbe becomes Ruta, and he comes back into Beryl's life. Beryl's position on Kibbe and on Ruta is that he is her equal. You know, he's not her servant, and it's because he was her most trusted childhood friend and then later becomes her most trusted ally, you know, the person who she can rely on maybe more than anyone else, even her father.
Is any of that documented beyond the novel?
That is intimated in West with the Night. Beryl doesn't go into as much detail as I do, obviously. But it's in the biographies of Beryl's life, this relationship was actually quite profound in Beryl's life.
It's different in that for most of these colonials, they're racists.
Of course, because that was the world. That was the world. So it was very unconventional for Beryl to have an African as a best friend and as an ally.
Is it possible that they were together?
You mean sexually? No, I actually don't think so. I mean, maybe in childhood or adolescence, as they were coming of age, there might have been some curiosity. I mean, certainly, as I say, Beryl is the most sort of tight-lipped woman who ever lived. She's not talking, so it's impossible to know. My particular suspicion is that he would never have dared because it might have gotten him killed. He was far too sensible for that.
In reading the Town and Country piece, one of the curious elements of this colonialism is that the farms that do still exist, they've become nature conservatories, protecting wildlife in ways that perhaps, you know, elsewhere in Africa, those don't exist, which is a curious positive element of what
happened. It is a legacy. It's a positive legacy for a very thorny bit of business in Kenya's history, because these families had vast land holdings, tens of thousands of acres of land that didn't really belong to them. And so now that they've been kind of handed over into these conservancies that protect the wildlife, it does seem to be a positive kind of offshoot or residue of those difficult decades.
I get the impression that Dennis Finch Hatton at one point kind of turned against hunting.
Yes. In fact, Dennis Finch Hatton was sort of one of the earliest conservationists on record and got a very bad taste in his mouth after a time about hunting and really kind of had seen the promise of photographic safaris before it existed.
And that, of course, brings us to the death of the lion, the dentist
poor
and the lion.
Cecil. I know. How shocking and appalling that whole story is.
Well, it also brings up the entire fact that the world oligarchs, like, for instance, the Trump sons, still go out and kill these wild animals.
And there are places in Africa where you can do it. Hunting's legal in portions of Tanzania, for instance, but not in Kenya, which outlawed trophy hunting, I think, in 1977. But the repercussions of that are actually very tricky because poaching didn't exist when hunting did. And so now part of the difficult legacy is that Kenya's wildlife is vanishing to poaching, something like 60 to 70% since hunting was abolished in the 70s, has disappeared.
In the book, there's a lot of mention about eating gazelle meat and meat from a number of animals, which they had to because that's what was there.
Those were the resources, right.
Better gazelles than kill the gazelles and bring in cattle. Did you eat any of that?
Did I eat any gazelle? No, I think the most exotic thing I ate was barbecued crocodile when I was in the Maasai Mara.
You went and saw some of the same ceremonies that barrel would have seen then.
Yes, I did. So I was able to visit a Maasai village and see an ngoma, you know, sort of the ceremonial dances. And it's really so striking and beautiful the way these Maasai Moran, the warriors, dance and sing and ululate. And what, one of the things that was most striking to me is, you know, in West with the Night, Burl talks about her friendship with Kibbe and how they're always egging each other on and competing. And one of the things that they do is dare each other to jump higher and higher, you know, that a warrior in training should be able to jump as high as his own shoulder from a standing position. And I just read that detail in West with the Night and I thought it was very compelling, but I didn't know what it meant until I went to Africa and saw these warriors dancing and then beginning to do this act, which is to jump, to sort of jump from a standing position. And I'm watching this beautiful thing and then realizing that the women aren't jumping. The women are singing and the women are watching, but the women aren't jumping. And that really spoke to me about Beryl, like that she really was a warrior.
She also had the advantage of being a white person in that society. She was not part of their group.
Yeah, she didn't really fit anywhere, right? She wasn't really part of her group, but she actually wasn't part of her own group either.
That's basically the story of Beryl Markham.
And that's how the universe creates a Beryl Markham.
So what happened after Circling the Sun? Circling the Sun is bookmarked, let's say, between the story of her trip, her flight from England to America, and her crash landing in, what is it, Newfoundland, 1936. What happened to her afterward?
Oh, dear. You know, the end of Beryl's life is so tragic, I like not to think about it.
But she was, what, 33 at the time? I mean, she lived another 50 years.
She did. So she went on flying. She went on training horses. She was one of the most celebrated racehorse trainers in Kenya's history. She trained horses well into her 80s. In fact, in 1942, she wrote this memoir, West with the Night, about her adventures in Kenya. And even that, I mean, it's such a fluke to me that Beryl would write that book. You know, Beryl had no literary aspirations. She really didn't. Someone suggested that she might write this book and that these tales might make her some money. Beryl never knew what to do with money. She was always on the verge of starvation. And so it was just a way to make money. It was a way to sort of try something new. She liked challenges. She liked to take on things she had never done before. So she thought, why not? I'll give it a go. When she began the book, she was actually living in California. She had gone to be a consultant on the set of the movie Safari. Like Hemingway, she has all these chapters of her life that seem not to have anything to do with the other chapters of her life. She kept reinventing herself.
So she went to America. Is that when she was married to the third husband?
Yes. So then she gets married to Ralph Schumacher. Beryl's third husband, Ralph Schumacher, was a Hollywood ghostwriter, and he very probably helped edit West with the Night. The gossip, and of course now I know you're quite familiar with her Wikipedia page, if nothing else, the gossip has always been that Beryl didn't write West with the Night, that in fact Ralph Schumacher wrote West with the Night, and he started that gossip. He's the one who said, you know, she didn't write that book. But again, sort of like this insistence that Harry, in fact, was Jarvis's father and not Mansfield Markham, even though the dates don't work out. Unless there was divine intervention, there's no way, biologically speaking, that Harry could be the father of Beryl's son. The same is true for West with the Night. Mary Lovell, Beryl's biographer, who has this marvelous book called Straight On Till Morning, discovered, in fact, evidence, hard evidence, that Beryl had delivered 16 chapters of West with the Night to her publisher before she met Raoul Schumacher. So even if he edited the book and his style is evident in the final version of the book, it's ridiculous that he wrote it and that it was his effort instead of hers.
She goes to Hollywood. She comes back to Kenya and she lives out her older years just horse training?
Yes. In fact, in a rented hut on the race course, or the grounds of the race course, with her dogs and, you know, famously, you know, drinking vodka at 10 o'clock in the morning and flirting audaciously with anyone who comes near her and really kind of being destitute. And then something sort of shocking happens. And I didn't know this until after I had begun the book, but what happens is that Hemingway comes into the picture. And, you know, Beryl met Ernest Hemingway when he was on safari with his second wife, Pauline, in 1934. That doesn't turn up in West with the Night. But Hemingway's son, John, who is Bumby in my book, The Paris Wife, was living in Los Angeles and was quite good friends with this restaurateur, George Gundkus, and was one day showing George his father's letters, was very fond of his father's letters. And one letter that Hemingway had written to Max Perkins, his editor at Scribner, way back when, said something like, "Have you read this book by Beryl Markham? It really is bloody wonderful, and she can write rings around the rest of us." He also called her a high-grade bitch in that letter. The letter was excerpted later for the jacket of West with a Night. But what happens is that George Gundkus is intrigued by this letter because he doesn't know who Beryl Markham is. And he sort of tries, you know, says like, well, so what is this book that the letter refers to? And he searches out West with a Night. It's out of print. He finds a way to get his hands on a copy and falls madly in love with it. And then writes Beryl, who is living in poverty in Nairobi, and says, "This is a magnificent book. And I'm going to reprint it." And he does, in fact, do that. And that's how it is that Beryl is able to live out the end of her days with some, you know, notoriety and a little more comfort than she had been accustomed to, and has Hemingway to thank for it.
And how many years between when the book is published, republished, and
when she dies?
Yeah.
It's a little less than 2 years.
So for the final 2 years of her life, she's suddenly...
She's a minor celebrity, yeah. And the book became a bestseller. So when it was first published in 1942, it all but disappeared in the wake of the Second World War. And so when it was published again, it became a bestseller. And if people know the book, it's because of that edition and because of that fluke.
In the end, it sort of comes around, and she has a good final couple of years.
She does. She does. You know, poor Beryl, though, she really did make things hard for herself, and there wasn't a place for her. There wasn't ever really a place for her. She was so unconventional, and she was probably too much, too aggressive, too bold for her own day. But I think she's a marvelous heroine for ours, and deeply fascinating, and definitely lived a life that is worth a second look.
Well, what is this book, The Splendid Outcast, which was compiled by Lovell?
Okay. So after Beryl's death, Mary Lovell collected and edited and then got published a collection of Beryl's stories that had been published in magazines, and some were unpublished. So after West with the Night, Beryl wrote a number of stories. At the time, it was a way, again, I don't want to paint her as a mercenary, but she was a very practical girl. You know, if there was money to be made publishing stories in Saturday Evening Post, then she was going to do that.
This seems to be hints, though, of course, not Encircling the Sun, that her marriage to Markham itself could have been a little bit of gold digging, because he was so rich.
To Mansfield Markham, her second husband.
Yeah.
Yes, although it's very funny. You know, I met Mansfield's godson when I was over in Kenya, and apparently Mansfield was really most efficient at losing money and probably lost the family fortune. And if Beryl was attracted to Mansfield because what he could offer her, it's also very probable that Mansfield was attracted to Beryl for the same reason. It was suggested to me by Mansfield's godson that Mansfield might have been homosexual and needed a beautiful girl on his arm to distract from the, you know...
That makes a lot of sense, just because if people are going to Kenya and anything can happen in Kenya, if you're a wealthy white British person down there, then there must have been quite a bit of gender looseness, if you want to call it
absolutely
that.
But it wasn't socially acceptable, at least not on the surface. And so to have this beautiful woman on his arm was probably a way, to sort of get the attention off of his own scent.
Paula McLean, now that you've written Circling the Sun, have you started work on another book?
No, I haven't. I love this genre, though. I love what I learn. I love history. I love kind of flinging myself into these gaps that I'm finding. I love that I now can sort of illuminate the lives of women who have somehow become sort of overshadowed or marginalized in history. And I hope that I know enough now about my own process that I won't bang my head against a wall for 2.5 years trying to find somebody new. For whatever reason, these subjects do need to find me, sort of like a crosstown bus, and knock me right on my keister. So I'll just wait for that moment, and hopefully I'll be awake.
Well, of course, two names come to mind, Pauline Hemingway and Karen Blixen, but that may be a little bit too close.
Thanks, Richard.
You've been listening to an interview with Paula McLean, whose latest novel about Beryl Markham is titled Circling the Sun. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.